Well, thank you for still being here, and thank you for your good attention the previous hour. Have basically the same objective for this period, and that is to encourage any of you who are deacons to continue to serve God in that capacity, or to encourage some of you to be thinking in terms of a willingness to serve the Lord as a deacon in His church. Now, I know for a fact that deacons are important to the work of the Lord for two reasons. I read about the church at Philippi, and Paul addressed that beautiful letter to the saints at Philippi with the bishops, the overseers, and the deacons. Deacons right up there identified as prominent in the leadership of God's people. Leadership is a word today that is used quite generally. Among business people, for finding real CEOs, real leaders. One of my boys is CEO for Willis Insurance in Nashville and Memphis. And back when he was in discussion about taking that responsibility, I'm going to tell you the main concern he had would be if he had to terminate somebody. He would just hate to have to do that. So I gave him whatever advice I knew about it. And one of the things I said to him, if you have to terminate somebody and they see that it's really hurting you to have to do that, that'll be very different from coming across as, well, you're out of here, like Donald Trump, you're fired. It's how you come across that'll make all the difference. But finding leaders in the Lord's church. Now, I read these books. John Maxwell, he's a guy that's known for leadership seminars and encouraging people and all that. And he says leadership is just one thing. It's influence. Well, after lecturing on leadership for a few years, I have my definition of leadership. Leadership for God's people is this: motivating the people of God to do the work of the Lord to the glory of God. There's motivation in leadership. There's no doubt about it. But we're talking about a unique work. We're not talking about a business, a corporation, a company. We're talking about the work of the Lord. And the purpose is not personal glory. Someone has said you can accomplish many things if you don't care who gets the credit. And I believe that's right. If you don't care who gets the credit, you can absolutely do things that you never dreamed could be possible. When we started the Diana Singing in 1969, we had no idea where it was going. We had no idea that people would come, usually from about 25 different states, to a little old place in Tennessee that doesn't even have a McDonald's, doesn't even have a store. Just a community out there with a big old shed, looks like a hay barn, dirt floor, a conglomeration of pews that brethren from all over the state have given us, and yet they come there. When we had our 40th anniversary, there were nearly 4,000 people that came there from 25 different states, as far away as Hawaii, Alaska. The point is, if you don't care who gets the credit, it's amazing what can be done. If it's a good work, there's the glory. And we're trying to bring glory and honor to God. Now, as we think about serving the Lord as a deacon, I want us to consider, first of all, that a deacon is a person that has a servant's mind. It's the way they think. And For a long time, they may still have this institute in Indianapolis where they would bring in leaders from the business community and teach them what was known as servant leadership, based of all things on the model of Jesus, the way he served. And to have that kind of mindset in a time when the world imagines that power and prominence, that's when you're somebody, not when you're a servant. If you're a servant, you're kind of on the low rung of the ladder. I was noting, and I noted this before, back a few weeks ago when I read through the book of Joshua again, 15 times in the 22 chapters of Joshua, Moses is identified as the servant of the Lord. 5 times in the first chapter, the servant of the Lord. Now ask anyone who has any kind of knowledge of the Old Testament, name me the prominent person in the Old Testament. They'll probably say Moses. Might say David, but probably they would say Moses. And they would be correct. Well, how did the greatness of Moses come? He was a servant of the Lord. Someone has said that serving is the rent that we pay for living. The rent we pay for living is serving. Deacons have that kind of mind. They have a mind of a servant. And in that mindset, as we're going to see, there is their opportunity and there is their potential greatness. Now, I want to move over to another area. They're men who recognize the honor. The emphasis is not on the honor. The emphasis is on the service. But the honor comes. Now, if you key on the honor, you miss the joy. It's possible for people to kind of get confused in religious matters and to key on the activity rather than the result. I'd give you examples from Jesus in Matthew 6 about giving. He said, when you give, don't do it, and I paraphrase, don't do it to make a show. When you give, don't sound a trumpet announcing what you're doing. You just give out of love, and God's going to reward you. But don't put the emphasis on the reward, put the emphasis on the action. Same thing was true with regard to praying. He said, when you pray, don't do it for show. Don't stand on the street and for a pretense make long prayers. Oh, here's a person. And this is one reason, you know, when the news shows people that at a given time or when you in a country and that tower starts giving the sound and everybody gets the prayer rug out and everybody kneels down on the prayer rug, that doesn't impress me at all. You know, doing something publicly there for a show, in a sense. Maybe they don't intend it for a show, but that's what it becomes. The kind of praying that impresses me, Jesus said, you go into the closet and you pray to your Father in secret. The kind of praying that really impresses God is what you do when you wake up in the morning and get down on your knees by your bed and start talking to God. Fervently, sincerely, pleading, beseeching, for people that you know and love that are in pain, difficulty, and hurt. I would imagine all of us here know somebody that right now is suffering. They're either suffering physically or they are suffering emotionally. I've been doing a study, not an official survey. I've just been doing a study the last 4 or 5 years. And here's what I've learned. I don't care who the person is. I don't care how high they may be politically, socially, or financially. If you get to really know that person so that they feel free just to kindly lay bare their soul, they've had hurt in their life. I haven't found an exception to that. They've had hurt somewhere in their life. And I have run into some people that seem to be doing quite well in business that may have to have special care for a son. I'm thinking about a man right now, a great Christian man, and managed one of these, well, they used to call them house trailers. They call them manufactured homes now. That sounds better, I think, manufactured home. Well, he managed one of those factories. And man lived in a nice house on a golf course. Walk out his front door and, you know, he's there. Has a son. I guess the boy probably is in his 20s now. It has maybe the mentality of a 2-year-old. Has to have special attention from this man and his wife all the time. Now, the average person, say just a fellow came by his office, he'd never know that. That's just one example. I could tell you, I could spend a lot of time today telling you about people that I have known or know that the average person would have no idea that they have to struggle with pain all the time, with disappointment all the time. Now, so far as I know, my 5 children and my 9 grandchildren, I got to get that in, and my 5 great-grandkids, so far as I know, were all healthy. And I thank God for that, and I pray every day, every morning, and every night that God will keep them from evil and harm. And I thank Him for their health. I thank Him for their jobs. I thank Him for their homes. And I know too many families where here's a little child that has leukemia, a little child that is battling. I know a prominent family right now that they have a grandson. They've had him in Vanderbilt Children's Hospital I don't know how many times, and they don't really know what's wrong with this child. And I know that has to be a burden on the hearts of these people all the time. Well, so when I think about the idea of serving others, I want to tell you something, folks. The person tomorrow that comes to the worship assembly, if the Lord delays His coming, you go up to that person tomorrow and you give them a warm handshake, you give them a sincere hug, you tell them how much you are glad to see them, you may never know. That's the person that needs someone to demonstrate, yeah, there's somebody that really cares for me. There's no doubt about that. I think about a man that came to me one Sunday after service, and he said, "Tom, if I didn't come here every Sunday, I don't think I could make it." He said, "My daddy has Alzheimer's. He doesn't know me. He calls me some terrible things. I know he doesn't understand it, but it still hurts me. I can come here and I can break from that ordeal. I can come here where people love me and it just renews my spirit." Don't ever underestimate that the card you send to somebody that's had a death in the family, the card you send to somebody that's in the hospital, don't ever underestimate what that little act of kindness can do to lift up the soul of an individual. When I think about men who recognize the honor, it's the honor of serving the Lord. It's the honor of serving other people. It's the honor of finding great joy through that kind of dedication. And it takes a lot of dedication to really serve the Lord as a deacon. Now, look at the honor in the word, the identification. Now you look at that word translated deacon, diakonos. Just to be able to say, okay, I'm serving as a deacon in God's church. Now the word that's translated deacon is sometimes translated servant. There's more than one New Testament word translated servant. One word identifies the relationship of a person to a master. But that's not the word deacon. This one identifies the relationship of a person to a work. And the work is God's work. And you could internalize 1 Corinthians 15:58. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. For your labor is not in vain in the Lord. The work of the Lord. The work that the Lord wants done. The greatest work on earth. Dealing with the eternal part of people. It's like a doctor in Hearn, Texas told me many years ago when I went out for a meeting. I was staying in the home of this doctor and his wife, and he owned the little hospital in that town, and every night after service we'd sit around their kitchen table and talk about what I did, talk about what he did. And one night he said, you know, I can go over here to the hospital and patch up a man, and maybe he has a few more years of life, but he's going to die eventually. But you're dealing with the eternal part of him. That's right. We're dealing with the eternal part of people. So men who serve as deacons, you don't have to take a back seat to anybody. It's like when I'm lecturing to preachers, I tell preachers, you don't have to take a back seat to anybody. If you are faithfully preaching the word of God, you're doing this great work for the Lord. Don't feel like that a businessman or a professional person, they're in the front seat and you have to take the back seat. No, no. I mean, you are front seat material right there. And don't ever forget that. So there is an honor in serving God as a deacon. But we also need to appreciate that we need men with a work ethic. I'm going to tell you, folks, what you already know. Work ethic is a bad term in the world today. I mean, that is a bad term. Work is a bad term. But having a work ethic, for several years, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, every Labor Day over at Manchester, Tennessee, they had a special gathering. And I was invited to come each year and make them a speech about labor for the Lord. And it was a great occasion. One man, he would barbecue shoulders. Boy, they had a feast every Labor Day. Things were going beautifully until somebody criticized his work and he just quit. And so the Labor Day was over. You know, you always have, like Jesus said about the poor, you have them with you always. You always have critics. Heard about two fellas walking by a street one time, or walking by a barber shop. And they put a branch of a tree in there, and they had an old owl in it. And the guys were looking at that owl, and one of them said, "That's the sorriest job of taxidermy I've ever seen. Look how he positioned the eyes on that old owl." And the other one said, "Yeah, and look how he's positioned the wings. Any taxidermist would know better than that." So after they had given their critique, the old owl flew to the back of the barbershop. Have you ever heard of armchair quarterbacks? I tell you, I've been over at Knoxville, Tennessee, sitting in a crowd of 100,000 people, and I have heard quarterbacks called stupid and a lot of other names, which I'll not repeat. And I have thought, when those people were sitting there, and I'm going to be nice about this, drinking their Pepsis, you know, drinking their Pepsis and rendering judgments about the quarterback on the field, I've often thought, what if you were down there and three guys, maybe four, coming at you, weighing nearly 300 pounds apiece, announcing in their approach they're going to put you under the AstroTurf? I wonder what you would do. I suspect you would say, "Which way is the showers, boys? I'm headed in that direction." It's one thing to be down in the arena of life. It's another thing to be on the sideline, observing and criticizing. So, there are a lot of folks that criticize. I heard it done in graduate school. They call it the Protestant work ethic. Criticize it. And give me so much work to do, I'd have to sit up all night to get it done. And I thought, to me, this is work too, you know. And Jack Eckerd founded the Eckerd drugstore chain. And Charles Colson and Jack Eckerd got together and wrote a book, Why America Doesn't Work. You know, the work ethic? And so I thought when I was doing those lectures, I better read that book. I listen to men now. Recently, I was in a meeting down in Alabama and went by a little factory that produces material for axe handles and hammer handles, hickory. So I'm talking to the owner of that factory. And I, you know, was talking about the production and so forth. And he said, well, I tell you, it's hard to find anybody that'll work anymore. Hard to find anybody that'll work. I grew up with a work. If the work ethic has died, it's died since my daddy was around. My daddy never had a course in psychology, but he knew more about psychology of boys than anybody I've ever seen. When we'd be picking cotton, and we picked it like you're supposed to with your hands, not with a machine listening to stereo music. If he had to go to town, for example, he would give me a quota. Now, Tom, when I get back, be sure that you have weighed up at least 50 pounds. So sometimes in panic situations, you wouldn't believe a Pepsi bottle would accidentally get in my sack. Occasionally a big rock or two, just kind of, wow, how in the world did those rocks get in there? But I had my 50 pounds because I knew if you don't have the 50 pounds, remember the peach tree down behind the hen house, and we're going to prune it in your behalf. That's motivation. You know, that's real motivation. And I grew up working. I was telling somebody recently the jobs that I have done in my lifetime. Cotton fields, plowing. When I came home from my freshman year in college, they were way behind with the plowing. I was already preaching every Sunday. So Monday morning at daylight, I got on a Massey Harris tractor. I plowed that thing all day Monday. I plowed it all Tuesday night. And I plowed it until sundown. I plowed it all Monday night and to sundown on Tuesday night when I'm nearly falling off of it. Now, that's work to me. I worked on a Dr. Pepper truck. I worked starting in the ninth grade. I got up at 3:30 every Saturday morning. Worked on a bread truck in Athens, Alabama for McDonald's Bakery. Worked at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Got paid $3 for that. I mean, I was demanding, you know, adequate pay for adequate work. And drove a truck for my brother-in-law. We used to come down to Ocala, Florida, start buying watermelons. Farmers bring them out, you know, put them under the trees, buy a load, haul them back to Athens, Alabama. And then I'd put a bunch of them on the back of a pickup, pedal those things. And, of course, taught in college 34 years, one year in high school. I went into college teaching after that for reasons I'll not explain. But like the college and university setting, a whole lot better. And did that. I helped carpenter work. I built some stuff when we lived in Henderson. And I would work in the summer months on those houses. And I could quit at 2 o'clock, get a shower, and get to Fayetteville, Tennessee, not on an interstate, in time for a 7 o'clock service. Did that. I mean, I've worked all my life. I was once professionally diagnosed as a workaholic. And I know I do it too much. I need to take a break from it occasionally. So one of the things the psychiatrist said, you need to go to AA meetings. You know, you're addicted to work. So I'd go to AA meetings and everybody'd start testifying. I'm Bill, I was an alcoholic for 20 years. I'm Francis, I was an alcoholic for 10 years. So I'd always be the last one. And then they'd finally all look at me. And I'd say, well, I'm Tom. I've never had a problem with alcohol, but they say I work too much. And there would be a chorus. I'm a workaholic. You're a what? Blow them out of their seats. I believe in work. I do. I make myself take off occasionally and not do it. I was mentioning to David, I've just finished a book on blessed assurance you can go to heaven and you know you're going. And when I'm writing a book, it obsesses me. And so Sunday night, a week ago, I was working on the last chapter. I came in from services and I said, I'm going to finish that chapter tonight. The next morning at 4 o'clock, I'm still working on it, but I just had to give up. Slept at 7:30, got up and finished it at 1 o'clock that afternoon. So work is something that I do, that I enjoy. I enjoy preaching. I absolutely thrill at the opportunity. It's not a burden to be born, it's a privilege to be enjoyed. And I guarantee you, if I served as a deacon, it would be something I would do with joy, because this is what I'm doing for the Lord. That's why I love this is what I'm doing for the Lord. This is a service I'm rendering to Him. The preaching that I'm doing and have done over 60 years of my life and plan to do as long as God gives me health and strength to do it. But I went to the Philippines 2 years ago to lecture to preachers over there. They've been using my homiletic books for several years in the Philippines, so they want me to come in and lecture to the preachers. And I came down, well, actually, later it was swine flu. I didn't know what it was. I just knew I'd never had anything like it. Energy, zero. Appetite, zero. Talking, out. And I'm here in the bed, and I'm thinking, man, I'll never be able to preach again. I can't sing anymore. So what am I going to do? I'm going to write it. If I can't preach it, I will write it. And I know books outlive you. And I can write songs. They'll outlive me. The great honor to me from song, they put 7 of my songs in that new hymnal that came out of Atlanta 4 or 5 years ago. I can write songs. I can write the gospel. And so I'll keep serving. God was good. He gave me back my voice, gave me back my health. And so for that, you better know I thank Him every day for giving me the health to do this work. So when I think about deacons having a work ethic, I would assume that all the deacons in this church have a good work ethic. Because it's hard for us to pigeonhole our lives. To say, okay, now I resent work. But now for the Lord, man, I'm going to be enthusiastic. It's hard to make that transference. I mean, we have a mindset. Now, I don't recommend that anybody go to the degree that I have with regard to work. That you just feel like a lot of times, I've got to be working at something. I can't just sit down. I absolutely now can go down to my little farm in Alabama and feed my fish and just stand there and enjoy watching them eat. I'm not working. I'm just absolutely enjoying this. And I can absolutely enjoy fishing now. Where I used to sit out there, man, I need to be teaching. I'm wasting my time here, you know. I'm out here fishing. I need to be teaching somebody the gospel. I need to be trying to encourage somebody to be restored. Now I can absolutely go and say, look, Jesus told the disciples one time, come aside and rest a while. You know, you need a break from it. And I used to, well, by the time I was a sophomore in junior in college, my summers were taken up with meetings. I held them from the time I got out of school till the time school started back, week after week after week. And that's when we usually start them on Sunday and go through Friday night or sometimes Saturday night and then start another one the next day. And I could tell just as well when I was pushing myself too hard. The least little thing would make me cry. After about 14 of those meetings, one right after the other, the least little thing would just, I'd say, uh-oh, you better back a little bit, because you obviously are imposing on yourself here too much. But I'm not ashamed of my work ethic. I'm not ashamed to work. And I could enjoy getting on that tractor again and smelling that dirt when you're turning that ground in the spring and listening to a tractor at 2 o'clock in the morning talk to you. They'll do it. You know, when everything is quiet and the atmosphere is just right, that motor will talk to you in such a beautiful way. I mean, it's not, well, man, would you hate at your age to get on a tractor and plow all night? No, man, I'd love to do that. When we were in Wisconsin back in the 50s, one of our members' son that helped on the farm cut his hand so seriously he couldn't work. And I told this brother, he was behind with his plowing, I said, I'll come out and plow for you. He thought I was kidding. College boy, gonna come out here and plow? Yeah, I grew up on a farm. I grew up driving a tractor. So I went out. Wisconsin has black dirt, if you've ever been in southern Wisconsin. Real, I don't know what the chemical is that turns it that color. But I went out with a nice khaki outfit on, you know, trousers crease in the legs, shirt crease. I get out, and this brother laughs at me. He just started laughing. I thought, what's the funny here? That night when I took my bath, you thought I'd been working in a coal mine. And my nice khaki outfit was, yeah, you've been in a coal mine, there's no doubt about it. But not everybody has a work ethic today. The one thing that I tried my best to teach my children, work. Honorable work. And when you start working, one of my oldest daughter started working at a Shoney's. Here's my little speech. You be the best employee they've got, because you're helping yourself when you are and you're hurting yourself when you aren't. That's what I tried to teach all of them. And my son that's now CEO, he started working at Cap'n D's. Same thing. And what he didn't know, Cap'n D's, they would send people around to check on the kind of service that's being given. You just thought they were a customer. And they would give awards, like, you know, tickets to a big restaurant downtown. And my son was winning those things going and coming, because he really believed when you are doing your best for a company, you're helping yourself, and when you aren't, you're hurting yourself. Back a few weeks ago, I was in a meeting over in West Tennessee at Greenfield, Tennessee, and I asked them if a little pajama factory was still operating over at Sharon, not far from there. They said, no, it's gone to China. I said, well, I made a speech to those people one time that worked at that factory. They invited me to come over and make a speech to the employees, not very big factory, about 125 employees. Got us out in a commons area, and they let me go. Just say whatever you want to say to them. And that was my speech. Folks, when you are helping this company, when you're being a good, dependable worker, you are helping yourself. And when you aren't, you are hurting yourself. It's just that simple. I don't know what impression it had, but I do know that when it was over, the management asked me if I had any children. At the time I had four. I said, yeah, I have four. I was teaching at Freed Hardeman. They said, well, come with us. So they gave me three pair of pajamas for each child. I get home, get them in a den. I said, okay, I've just made a speech at a pajama factory. Here are your pajamas, yours, yours, and yours. Well, my two little boys, they thought they were handicapped because they didn't have a mini bike. That's when the mini bike thing was really in. So one of the little boys told his mama, he said, oh, I hope he speaks next week at a mini bike factory. Would you believe next week they had their mini bike because I used plastic money to get it for them if they needed it that much. But this is where I operate. My oldest brother did not want me to become a preacher. He'd seen preachers treated sometimes ways he didn't want me treated. And so he didn't want it. But once he saw, I was determined to do it. Then he gave me some advice. And part of the advice was something that Daniel Webster, a prominent lawyer one time in this country, gave a young aspiring attorney who came and said, Mr. Webster, I want to become a lawyer, but I understand the legal profession is crowded. And Webster said, not at the top. And my brother said, if you're going to be a preacher, you be the best one you can become with God's help. Now, my brother's been dead for years, but he will never know how that has motivated me. I cannot be satisfied with mediocrity in myself. I've got to be the best I can be for God. That's your work ethic. I'm working for the Lord. How a person could say, I don't want to do that. It's the Lord's work. That's incredible. So, if you've got a good work ethic, you can serve as a deacon if you have the other qualifications. Okay, now there's something else with regard to a deacon. Men of strong faith. Maybe I need to read it to you. Maybe it'll be more impressive. Please listen to this as Paul is giving the qualifications for deacons. Holding the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. Mystery. That's a very interesting New Testament concept. Our English word mystery identifies material that excites the imagination but defies explanation. That's not a Bible mystery. A mystery in your New Testament is something that you could never know unless it's been revealed. But once it's been revealed, you can potentially, if you read it, understand it. Now that's straight out of Ephesians 3, when Paul started in verse 1 by saying, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you. He's pleading with these people. I'm the prisoner of the Lord. I've been a Roman prisoner, he could say. And now I'm beseeching you, I'm encouraging you to let you know that I've been given a dispensation of the grace of God, literally a ministry of God's grace. And he said to make known a mystery. And this has been revealed unto his holy apostles and prophets by the Spirit. Then he says, when you read, you may understand my knowledge in the mystery of Christ, which in other ages was not made known unto the sons of men, as it hath now been revealed unto his holy apostles and prophets by the Spirit, whereby when you read, you may understand. Now there's the problem. Reading. Now, I don't know what you think when you hear the word read. Are you thinking a visual perception going across some little things, and we call them letters, you know, written letters. Are you thinking about visual perception going across those? Or are you thinking about visual perception taking those letters and through a very involved process translating that into your very intellect and you see it in your mind? Visual perception, by the way, is one of the fascinating accomplishments of a human being. If you doubt that, read Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. Behe is a biochemist. And in the process of talking about visual perception and how incredible it would be for a little object out in the sea to develop some little reaction to light that later would become an eye. He said there are too many things that are working together for visual perception to imagine anything like that even occurring. Visual perception by which I am transferring actual sight. And you know, technically, you don't see with your eye, you see with your brain. The eyes is the camera. It's the means of getting the information. And there's a translation in this physiological process into an electrical impulse that shoots the image up there to the brain where you actually have the perception. Well, Paul said when you read, the word he used that's translated read is a compound word which literally means to know again. Onogenosis. You know it again. It's clear. I mean, you see it. It's the image. One time in graduate school, Christmas break came and I discovered I was 5,000 pages behind in outside reading. Well, if you take an average book of 300 pages, guess what I did over the Christmas break at school? Read. I let my eyes pass across the letters. That was my reading. And I can honestly say, You know, I read in a sense, my eyes passed over. But now, if you'd given me a test over all those books, I might have had a little difficulty right there. Now when I read, I have to put my mind on it. I was amazed that my children, when they were in school, could be down in the den floor with a stereo going, studying. That used to always amaze. How do you do that, you know? I've got to have quietness so I can put my mind on it, so I can concentrate. Now, a mystery from the standpoint of the Bible is what you can't understand till God has revealed it. But once revealed, you could read it and then understand it and understand what Paul understood. To me, that's a fascinating thing. Now, here are men who have the faith. They hold that faith, and they have it because they understand the mystery, the revelation of it. And they hold it with a pure conscience. I fear that maybe in the past a lot of the information given about the conscience has been from a negative perspective. Your conscience is not a safe guide in your religion. Now that's true unless the conscience is safely guided. But I don't want anyone to ever get the impression from what I teach that the conscience is kind of insignificant and unimportant. Because the conscience, when Paul gave this epitome of Christianity in 1 Timothy 1 and 6, he said, now the end of the commandment, the aim, the design, the purpose of the commandment is love out of a pure heart and of a good conscience and of faith unfeigned. See those three essentials? Now, a good conscience. What is the conscience? If your Bible is open and you put your finger over the prefix of the word conscience, you're going to end up with the word science, right? Well, we all understand science means to know. Take your finger off, and the prefix means with. A knowing with. Conscience is a knowing with ourselves. Conscience is the God-given ability for self-knowledge. And when the conscience is pure, you can live with yourself. You can look yourself straight in the mirror and not be embarrassed nor ashamed. If it's not pure, you're condemned. By your own heart, as John would say. If our own heart condemn us, God is greater than our heart and knows all things. But if my conscience is pure, then I have a sense that I'm right. Now, that sense may not be right unless my conscience has been properly educated. If my conscience has been properly educated to know what is right from the word of the Lord, and I'm consistent with that, good conscience. If my conscience has been educated in the work of the Lord, word of the Lord, of what is right, and I'm not consistent with that, there's a self-condemnation. And, you know, sometimes have you ever had something on your mind to the point it just came out when you didn't mean it? Some would say about things. Freudian slip, for example. The best example I've ever heard of a fellow having something on his mind and it just came out at the wrong time. One of my students grew up down near Birmingham. And Ray told me when he was a kid, one Sunday afternoon, they lived out on the farm. Parents were gone visiting. And he and his brother decided they'd get the old farm truck out and drive it. Neither of them had a driver's license. So they talked about, well, what if the highway patrol stops? They said, oh, we live so far out, they don't come out this far. So Ray said his brother was about 2 years older, so the brother said, I'll do the driving. He got the old truck out, didn't have a muffler, so you can imagine the noise it made. He said, oh, we were having such a big time. Came over a hill, and the trooper had chased a bootlegger and had stopped him right in the middle of the road, had the trunk of his car open, and Ray said, we had to stop. Well, there they old truck, bloom, 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 bloom. And one of the troopers walked back and said to his brother, and Ray said, my brother, he was gripping that steering wheel. His knuckles were already turning white and wouldn't look at the trooper. And the trooper said, son, she's making a lot of racket, isn't she? And his brother said, yes, sir, I think part of the driver's license fell off. Yeah, part of the driver's license fell off. He said, by the way, let me see your driver's license. Didn't have it. Well, you can get something on your mind, it just comes out, you know. Well, When you have a pure conscience, you can live with yourself. You can go to sleep night, don't have thorns in your pillow. Got a pure conscience. If a man's going to serve the Lord in the capacity of a deacon, he needs to hold the mystery of the faith. I mean, he needs to understand it. He's read it. He understands it. Not ashamed of it. Will stand for it. And he does that with a pure conscience. Now, he has one of the qualifications to serve as a deacon. Man of strong faith. Quickly, one other thing here. He's a man with family support. Now, I am fully aware that when you start reading about the wives of deacons, that word wives will be in italics. And you know what that means. When you find a word in your Bible in italics, it means the translator supplied that word to complete the thought. And there are people today who are arguing for women deacons, not just on the basis of that, but also about Phoebe. Romans 16:1, Paul said he commended Phoebe, who was a servant of the church in Cenchrea. And that word translated servant is the feminine form of diakonos, deacon. But there's a lot of difference in serving, ministering, and having the qualifications to serve in, if you please, an official capacity. And the thing that lets me know that it's not an abuse of the text to put the word their wives must be reverent and not slanderous and so forth is the fact that it goes right on to say that the deacon must be the husband of one wife. Now that seems to settle the issue. It wouldn't for people caught up in the feminist movement who believe that two women can be married. But it's going to be a loose use of the word husband to say one of the women is a husband. I don't know what terminology they use. I've heard, but I'm not sure it's accurate, the terminology that would be used in that kind of relationship. Certainly not a biblical one. But if this man's going to serve as a deacon, is to be the husband of one wife, then it seems to me that to say, well, a wife can be a deacon would present a real problem for her. And it's kind of a sly statement right there, facetious. Now, if a man's going to serve as a deacon, he's got to have good family support, because it's going to take a lot of time to do that. The wife could resent it. You need to be here with the kids. You need to be helping me with the kids. And you're up there trying to take food to somebody, or trying to do this, or take food up there for folks that were hurt in that tornado and so forth. And you need more time with the family. And he has to have a wife that says, in essence, says, my husband's doing the work of the Lord. I'm going to encourage him every way that I possibly can. And same thing would be true with an elder's family. If an elder has a wife that understands my husband doing the work of the Lord, the greatest work on earth, I'm going to encourage him in it. We'll make sacrifices in order for it to be done. If a deacon doesn't have family support, if he's got to go it on his own, alone, that's going to be more demanding than it would be otherwise. Kind of like a preacher. If you don't have family support and you have to go it alone and on your own, you've got to just kindly encourage yourself alone. And you've got to remind yourself, I'm doing the greatest work on earth here for the Lord. And I'm not going to quit. I'm not going to get down on myself. I'm not going to get discouraged and throw in the towel. I'm going to keep working and I'm going to keep serving. Well, like I say, if you men that are serving as deacons, if I've said anything to remind you of the honor of what you're doing, the importance of what you're doing, to God be the glory. If some of you are thinking in terms, one day I'd like to serve the Lord as a special servant, and that's what deacons are. They are special servants. And start preparing yourself for that work. It would be a great thing if the elders could look around and say, oh man, we've got these fellows. They're willing to work. They've got a good work ethic. They understand it is a place to serve. They've got a mindset to serve. And we believe that they'll do a great job serving the Lord as they serve His people. And so consequently, if the elders come to you and ask you if you would consider serving the Lord as a deacon, I hope by then you would be so prepared and even anxious to serve the Lord in that capacity that you would be ready, willing, and even anxious to so serve the Lord. And as surely as you do, then I promise you something. One sweet day, here's some words you're going to hear. Well done, good and faithful servant. And when the Lord says that to you, you'll say, man, I thank God that I could serve as a deacon in the church His Son bought with His blood. Thank you for your good attention.